I would like to introduce our main speaker for the evening, Mike B. from San Diego.
Good evening. I'm Mike. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi.
How do I look, Mark? I was talking to Larry. He said, when you lack content, dazzle him with your wardrobe. I want to thank Terry and the group for inviting me to do this, even though I would rather be having four root canals than be up here. I was telling Candor before the meeting, I said, yeah, I says, you know, what they don't understand here is, because I've been around for a while, I've been sober since March 14th of 1988. And the person that they see today is not the person who walked in the door, and certainly not the person who spent the previous 41 years being afraid of absolutely everything in life. And my number one goal, as you can tell, was to make sure you didn't find that out. And, you know, I was telling her that I took a class in high school because I was getting ready to graduate, and I was absolutely scared to death of what I was going to do and where I was going to go and how I was ever going to interview for a job and all these kind of things. So they offered a public speaking class. And I took the public speaking class, and I failed it. And right then, you know, I made that conscious decision that, you know, the one thing you're never going to be, Mike, is a public speaker. And that was fine with me. You know, that was fine with me. But today, as uncomfortable as it is for me to be up here, the message that I have to carry of my story and what the program of Alcoholics Anonymous and so many of the people in this room have done for me is something that I feel needs to be told. And we all have a story, and only we can tell our story. I was born in Balboa Navy Hospital. It'll be 61 years ago next week. My mom was had been in the service in the Women's Navy and the Waves, and had an affair with after she got out of the Waves, and was working at an Air Force base and had an affair with an Army Air Corps pilot and during the war, and got pregnant, and he said, you know, typical flyboy, said, well, your problem, see ya. And so my mom came to San Diego to have me at the Balboa Navy Hospital because she could have me for free, and she didn't have any money. And so the first 5 years I spent living in foster homes, being bounced around, and that wasn't because she didn't love me or didn't want to be there. It was because she had to go out and make a living, and the only job she could get was working nights in cocktail lounges and whatnot. And then she married my stepdad, an Italian tuna fisherman, and I went from having no father and no family. I was thrown into this huge Italian family living down in Little Italy. And, you know, I might as well have been thrown in, I don't know where, but, you know, I felt like I fit in about as much down there, because here was this little towhead, white-haired boy, fair skin, you know, with all these big, tough Italian guys in the neighborhood. I mean, they weren't yet, but they were going to be. And you know us alcoholics, we have great insight. You know, into how things are going to be long before they ever happen. And so, you know, and this family loved me, you know, they loved me as well as they gave me as much love and admiration and all this stuff as they could possibly give me. But by this time I had decided in my mind, that little child's mind, that I was unlovable. And so I had no way of letting that in. And so I learned at a very early age to look the part and nobody will have to know. And so that's how I spent the rest of my life before I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, was being what the book calls the actor. You know, I will be anything I need to be to fit in with whatever group I need to fit in. And it was very difficult. You know, when I went to junior high school, I would hang out way out at the tennis courts every morning before school started. And then when I'd hear the bell ring, I'd run to the bathroom and I'd throw up and then I'd go to class. And I don't say that for sympathy, but this is just this. I'm trying to give you a picture of where I came from and how broken I was. And when I got into high school, it was the same thing. You know, I joined the club in the neighborhood, the ITAMs, you know, Italian Americans, you know, gold chains and club jackets and cigarettes and, you know, all that kind of stuff to make you look badass. And here I was standing in the corner. We'd have these big dances down at Bayside Social Club, and I'd be standing in a corner, you know, they're just giving as tough a look as a little white boy can give, you know. With that jacket on and that cigarette hanging out of my mouth, thinking, God damn, I hope nothing happens to me. You know? Because we were supposed to be like the bouncers if something went down, you know. And it was tough. It was tough being me. And I'm glad I can laugh about it now, because I didn't laugh about it for a long time. In fact, very shortly thereafter, I started drinking about that. And all of a sudden, in my mind, I was that tough guy, you know? And I remember going to my first dance at University High School with a buddy of mine, and we bought a six-pack of Tall Country Club malt liquors, I think it was. And we each drank three out in the parking lot. And then we went into the dance. And, man, all of a sudden, I'm dancing. And then somebody started picking on my cousin. And I went over and I beat this guy up. And I'm like, I've arrived. You know? I didn't know all you needed to do was add alcohol. And you'd be okay. And be all the things that you thought you wanted to be. You know? And, of course, that night I was out in the parking lot throwing up. And I couldn't wait to do it again. And that's how it kind of progressed for me, you know. And then when I was in my early 20s, all my friends started getting married, and I had no clue about direction. You know, I went to Mesa College for a while, and that scared the hell out of me because they thought I had a brain, and I knew I didn't. And, I mean, their test scores said I did, but I obviously they'd confuse me with somebody. So, you know. My dad got really pissed off, my stepdad, because he wanted us all to go to college because he'd had it rough, you know. And when I said I wasn't, he said, well, you might as well go drive a truck then, because that's all you're ever going to amount to. Because that's what he was doing at the time. Fishing had gone bad, and he started driving a truck. And so I went, direction. That's what I've been looking for, you know. So I got in a truck, and I've been driving a truck for the last 38 years. But as I was about to say, all my friends started getting married, and like I say, I'm always looking for direction. So I'm at when I'm 23 years old, I'm at an Italian wedding at the Atlantis, used to be the Atlantis Hotel down in Mission Bay. And the band took a break, and so I went up, I had a gal and I'd invited to the thing, and I went up when the band took a break and invited everybody to our wedding. I guess this is what you're supposed to do next, you know? I add alcohol, and I get these brilliant ideas. And so I wound up married. And a week into it, I knew I'd married the wrong woman. But, you know, one thing my stepdad gave me was some strong principles. And I thought, you know, I'm not going to be just another statistic. I'm gonna make this work, and I'll build a life around my kids, you know. Which I didn't have yet, but there's that great insight that we have, you know. So I stayed married, had a child, And when she was about five, I tried to leave because I was sitting watching television one night and I just started shaking uncontrollably. And I told my wife, I said, I can't do this anymore. And she said, oh, okay, I understand. Well, let me go outside and get your daughter and bring her in here so you can tell her how you're going to abandon her just like your father abandoned you. Well, never mind. You know, wasn't that important, you know. Nervous breakdowns happen to everybody, you know. So, you know, we had another child. I thought, okay, I'll build my life around the second child. And 11 years into that marriage, I was stark raving mad. And so we divorced. And life got hard. I was paying an awful lot of alimony. Of course, I gave her the house that I'd bought, and because of the kids, I wanted them to have a place. And I left with my pickup truck and my suitcase of clothes, not knowing where I was going one more time or what I was doing. But I knew alcohol would be there waiting for me, and wouldn't have her to be, you know, because, you know, she used to, even then, she used to leave these pamphlets, you know, around the house that her clients would give her. You know, this alcoholism, you know, AA stuff, you know, and I used to look at that and think, how insulting. You know? I'm working my butt off to support you, you know, and you got a lot of, you know, gall. I mean, because that's what I did. You know, I worked my fanny off at very hard jobs. I'd go home, I'd do the cooking, the cleaning, you name it. I did it around the house to preserve my right to drink. Because I didn't say, well, if you had all the responsibility I've got, you'd drink too, you know. And she even went so far as one time telling me that one of her clients told her, who had been a psychologist before, told her that it sounds like your husband suffers from the Peter Pan syndrome. He doesn't want to grow up. Well, yeah. So? You know, it works for me. And, you know, so it proceeded, you know, my alcoholism. And, you know, what I got to say, it didn't go anywhere good. It didn't. I got married again shortly thereafter, and I was married to that woman for 11 years, 12, 11 the first one, 12 the second one. And, you know, trying to make things work and alcoholism getting worse. And, of course, there was always other things. This is not meeting the Alcoholics Anonymous, so I'm not going to mention those things. But they were always there, too. And, you know, my alcoholism just continued to get worse. And I was dying a slow death, even when I wasn't drinking. And I showed up to work every day. I was everybody's great employee because I worked twice as hard to feel half as good, you know. And unfortunately, like I say, I was dying inside. And just like it had been the case my whole life, I couldn't tell anybody because they were going to say, well, what's wrong? I don't know. I knew I'd do something about it. You know? I had no idea what was wrong with me. And so I just kept drinking and doing that stuff and trying to eke out an existence and you know, coming up with wonderful... This is the kind of stuff alcohol did for me. You know, gave me brilliant ideas. You know? I remember being at parties and come up with these just incredible plans for businesses that me and whoever I was talking to were going to start and how successful we were going to be. And then the next morning, wake up and go, oh, my God, what? Is that God?
What's the point, Mike?
Where was I going now? Oh, the brilliant ideas, yes. When I was married to that first wife, you know, and had bought our first new house in Mira Mesa, you know, a big four-bedroom house. Oh, you know, I'm so proud. And one night, you know, it's like I think it was the middle of August, and I'm sitting there in the middle of the living room with one of those big old 5-gallon candles. Some of those, you know, people have been around a while. I know Al remembers those. All carved out and everything, really cool, you know, and stuff. You did really weird things with them, you know, when you were doing really weird stuff. And I'm sitting there, and I got a $3,000 stereo, and I got the headphones on, and I'm blasting out, I don't know, Inagata DeVita or something. And I get this idea. The Christmas tree is still out in the backyard from last winter. You know, we're not real quick about getting into doing stuff, you know, responsible stuff. So the middle of the night, my wife and daughter are sleeping. I get up, and I go out in the backyard with a saw, and I'm stuffing the fireplace because I've never had a fire in the new fireplace, you know. And I got that tree, and of course, you know, I'm an alcoholic, so, you know, the tree was massive. And I got that tree stuffed in there, and then I thought, because I didn't know, I thought, well, it's probably going to be a little hard to light. I need some lighter fluid. Well, I couldn't find the lighter fluid from the barbecue, so I went in the garage, and I'm looking around, and went, oh, camping, white gas. Just a couple, you know, shots. And I stood there like this. Now, I had a full beard at the time and long hair. And I hit that match and threw it in there and bobbed. Just like a cartoon. You know the cartoon where the flames come out across the room? It blew me all the way against the wall over there and went up the wall. The flames. Just like... And, of course, the first thing I did was went... I still got hair. And you know, then the next thing I did was look at the carpet to make sure it wasn't singed, and somehow it wasn't because the fireplace was raised. And I never told the wife, and you know, she just wouldn't understand. You would have understood. You went, oh wow, let's do that again. You know? Because you're my people, you know? But I still didn't know that. I still didn't know you were my people, you know? I'm still dying. And then there's the other time we went with a big group of people out to the Valley High restaurant out in Point Loma, Shelter Island. We're all dressed up, and we get there, and the women wanted to go. It's not a guy kind of place, you know? And, my wife walks up and says, party at 10, you know, da-da-da-da-da. She comes back, says, oh, it's going to be about an hour and a half. I've already been drinking, you know. That won't do. We don't wait, you know. So I went back up, and I said, excuse me. Yes, Dr. Bernardino, party of 10. See what you can do for me, sweetheart. Well, yes, doctor. Brilliant idea. We no sooner got sat down, got our drinks in front of us, we're having a good time, and all of a sudden, bam, the guy at the table next to us drops. See, for those of you who don't know and ever want to, you know, decide to leave here and go out there and try it again, don't make that mistake, because the first thing a restaurant does is goes and looks on there, because they write it down. In case things like this happen. Nobody told me. So they run up, Dr. Bernardino, Dr., can you do something? And I went right into, you know, well, my insurance and, you know. And I hemmed and hawed for about 10 minutes. And you know, of course, the entire restaurant is looking at me with disgust, like, you're a doctor. And I finally had to cop to it. And then the looks got worse. They didn't ask us to leave, but they kind of threw the plates at us when they'd bring us anything, you know. And everybody in the restaurant just total disgust, you know. But, you know, that's what alcoholics do. You know, you add alcohol to us, And strange things happen. Strange thoughts happen. And so I'm continuing, you know, to drink, and it's continuing to get worse. And it's hard to remember exactly when, because I was so sick at the time. But between 1 and 2 years before I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, I want to preface that by saying that no one would have ever known this was going on with me. I had a very large family. They all looked up to me. All my friends looked up to me. They thought that Mike's got the world by the tail, you know. And I couldn't tell them. I didn't. But, like I say, about a year and a half, 2 years, something like that, before I got to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, I called the wife one day when I got off work, and we had a little scuffle on the phone. It was nothing. I don't even remember what it was. That's how important it was. But when I hung that phone up, I thought, you know, I'm just tired. I'm tired of trying so hard and not knowing what's wrong with me and not knowing what I got to do to appease people, you know, to get them off my back or to make them understand or whatever. And so I sat down and I wrote an open letter to my wife, to my second wife, my kids, my family, friends, everyone who'd ever come in contact with me, apologizing for the failure I'd been in their life, because that's exactly how I felt. And I grabbed a sleeping bag and I hitchhiked out of town, going nowhere. And I got a ride as far as Escondido and you got to realize, I got this old army pea coat on. It's raining, and, you know, if I looked like this, they'd have probably picked me up. But I couldn't get a second ride. And it's getting later, and it's getting colder, and it started to rain harder. And I remember going underneath the bridge there, right at Valley Center Parkway on the freeway, and just starting to bawl my eyes out, thinking to myself, how does someone who tried so hard wind up here? Because I just didn't know what was wrong. And eventually that night I brought myself to call my wife and ask if I could come home. And she says, I'll be right there. Don't go anywhere. We've all been out looking for you. And when she picked me up, I got in the car and I said, I can't talk about it right now. I'll talk about it when I can. And I never brought it up again, and neither did she. Because I didn't know what was wrong with me. And a year and a half or so later, she one day, one of her clients who was in the program brought her some literature, and she brought it home, and she said, you can either go to AA or get out. And I was scared to death of being abandoned, you know, still at 41 years old. I was still that little kid who was scared to death of being abandoned. And so I said, okay. And I went to AA. And through the grace of God, you know, that gift we get here, that magical gift that a lot of us get here, that the desire, and by now I'm drinking 24 hours a day and I'm doing a whole lot of other stuff 24 hours a day. Doesn't matter what it is, if it makes me feel different than I feel, I'm doing it. And I went to AA and I was relieved of the desire, the obsession. And I wasn't talking to anybody, and I didn't get a sponsor, and because I thought this stuff was all kind of below me. You know, I felt sorry for you people. You know. But obviously you didn't come from where I came from, and you didn't have all the philosophical, you know, studying that I'd done, trying to fill that void that was inside me that nothing seemed to fill, you know, and the Eastern philosophies and blah, 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 you name it, you know, oming myself into the stratosphere and, you know. So what happened was 6 months later, you know, the wife's happy. We're back, you know, we're the household's happy. I've got a job. Everything seems to be going good. Listen to that. Everything seems to be going good. I'm driving to the beach because she's going to get off at 1 o'clock. It's a Saturday. And I'm waiting for her. And I thought, oh, I think I'll take a ride down to the beach. Well, I'm taking a ride down to the beach, so, you know, for an hour or so, alcohol sits up next to me because, see, I haven't worked the steps. I haven't got a sponsor. And I haven't done what you suggested here. Because I was one of those too smart for my own good kind of guys, you know. More than anything, though, I think I was just scared to death that if Alcoholics Anonymous didn't work for me, where would I go? You know, where would I go? And so that day driving down the beach, alcoholic sat up and said, let's have a drink. And I was absolutely powerless not to have that drink that day. And that desire had been gone for everything from that first day. That's what we're dealing with here. That's what we talk about when this, we say, a life and death situation here. You know? We have a disease. The disease of alcoholism. It's just like a cancer or any other disease. It will eat us away and kill us if we don't do something about it, something to relieve that inner turmoil. And so I got drunk that day. I mean, I took a drink, and 5 minutes later I was on my way to get other stuff, and I got drunk that day. And to show you how this disease works, I thought, okay, I'm not going to tell the wife, and I'll go back to AA because it didn't work. I knew it wasn't working. If it was working, I'd still be out there. You know, it wasn't working anymore. I couldn't drink or do anything else enough to get rid of that inner stuff anymore. And for a week, I went to meetings. And you know what alcoholism told me? It said, Mike, you know, it figures you haven't done anything right in your life. You went out and you didn't even get good and drunk. You know? And so a week later I did. Because I had to. Because it wouldn't stop. You know? I had that committee up in my head just eating at me 24 hours a day like it had for the last 41 years. Giving me bad information. And so I came back and I went to a meeting list out that day, next day, and it was a Friday. And I got down on my knees for the first time and I asked God, I said, send me where I need to be to get this deal. And I ran my hand down and it stopped on a closed men's meeting. I went, oh, anything but that. You know, I'm scared to death of women, and I just don't have that, you know, there wasn't a t-shirt black enough for the wimp inside of me, you know? So I don't relate to guys, man, they're going to eat me up alive, chew me up, spit me out. But I went, because I said I would. And there was a guy there that they called on me to share, and a guy asked me to, after the meeting, to go to coffee. And for the first time I did. And he said, have you worked the steps? And I said, no. He said, do you want to? I said, yes. He said, be in my apartment tomorrow morning at 6 o'clock. I said, okay. And I spent that Saturday morning, whether it was 6, I spent 14 hours locked up in his apartment doing the first 8 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. Because he knew how desperate I was. And that if he didn't do something to relieve some of what was going on inside of here, I may not get another chance. And that's exactly what happened. It relieved enough inside of there that what was left, you know, allowed me to start working this program, start going to meetings, start listening to you in a way. Because, see, when I came here, I looked for all the differences. And that's all I saw. When I came back, I looked for the similarities. And that's all I saw. You know? That's why I can say you are my people here. Because it doesn't matter what you look like, where you've been, what level you're on, you know, in status in our society or whatever, you know. We're all just alcoholics recovering from a fatal disease one day at a time. And, you know, when I came in here and I started doing some of these things, and fortunately I got a sponsor. Well, I didn't say, I shouldn't say, God brought me a sponsor. This funny little guy up at Old Town Speakers, he used to run across the room, Donnie T., hey, how you doing, man? And I was like, I'm not gay. You know? Because he'd have this exuberance in him, you know? It was just like, whoa, he was electric, you know? And I thought, sure, that's what he wanted from me. And I don't play that. Nothing wrong with it, but it's not for me. He just kept coming back and kept bugging me. And I started following him around, asking him to be my sponsor. And I followed him around like a lost puppy dog. You know, and he was very much into meetings, very much into the social functions of AA, and very much into the spiritual. I don't like to use the word side in this program because it's all spiritual. But he was very much into the God thing. You know, he'd say, you know, come on, give it the sniff test, he used to say. If you don't like it, we'll gladly refund your misery, you know. But give it the sniff test, you know, just try it. You know, so he'd load all of us guys, six or eight of us newcomers, into a van, and we'd be off going to, I mean, besides doing the steps and reading the book and doing all the other things in AA, he went outside of AA, you know, too. And he would take us to spiritual centers all over the place, you know, getting us a new concept of God, a God that we could do business with. You know, because the book tells us that. We got to let go of all of our old ideas, not just the bad ones. Because for most of us, it's the good ones that are killing us. You know, as I've just attested to here a few minutes ago, you know, my great ideas. That's kind of what he did, and I never forget going on a retreat with Mr. Floyd back there and Don, my sponsor. They kind of hijacked me and took me all the way up to Lancaster, a place called Valley Arimo. It was some kind of a monk place, you know. And I didn't want to go, and I didn't want to be there, and I didn't feel connected because I still, you know, was pretty new and raw, and you know where I just told you where I came from and how afraid I was. And what happened that weekend changed my life in sobriety. Because there was a guy there, I call him Mexican John, and I don't say that in an ethnic way. I love him. Every time I see him, I say, hey, Mexican John, you know, because he's real dark, dark Hispanic man, very dark skin. And he was at this retreat. And I tried to connect with everybody else, but they'd been on the retreat before, and they were kind of doing this, you know, oh, we love each other, aren't we wonderful? And I'm dying here, you know, and I need a hug, you know. So I saw John out by the duck pond out back, and so I went out and I sat down next to him. Hey, how you doing, man? And he turned to me with the meanest, nastiest look. He just like burned a hole right through this little wimp. And I thought, okay, that's it. You know, as soon as I can get out of this, if I could have got a cab, I would have, but I'm in the middle of no place. As soon as I can get out of this place, I'm gone. Because these people are bullshit. This is just like it was out there, you know. With a whole different set of principles. You know? And so I made that decision that day. And that Saturday night they had a meeting where everybody was supposed to share. Oh, yeah, wonderful, all from the heart. Yes, God, you know, about God and the duck pond and, you know, we're in this wonderful place. And, the eye of the needle and... No, I'm Mexican, John. You know, I'm not talking to anybody. You know, you people are foolish. You know. So everybody shares this night, and it's wonderful, and they're doing all this deal. And all of a sudden, the meeting's over, and the lights go out. Oh, now, let me preface that just one minute. That afternoon, Saturday afternoon, I saw a bunch of people going to get in their car. Okay? They were going into the town of Lancaster. And I thought, if I can get to Lancaster, maybe I can get a ride. You know? So I walked up and I said, excuse me. You know, you guys are going into town, I heard. Can I catch a ride with you? And they all gave you that look. You know? And I said, I know that look. You know, that you don't fit in here, look. And I immediately said, wait, never mind. I forgot I was supposed to do something with my sponsor, and I went out back, you know. And I just thought, you know, this is bullshit. You know? And so that night, after they have the meeting and everything, they went in and they shut the lights, and they walk out with a birthday cake, singing happy birthday. And I'm thinking, some poor fool here's got a birthday and it's morning. Well, I ain't singing and I ain't clapping and I ain't doing nothing. I just want to get out of here. Well, unbeknownst to me, my sponsor Donnie T had leaked it. I didn't even know he knew that it was my birthday that weekend, that day. And these people, you alcoholics, had piled in a car on a weekend retreat that you had spent money for and driven 100 miles out to the middle of no place to go buy me a birthday cake. That's the kind of people you are. That's the kind of people we become when we stick around here. You know? And do these simple things. And I'm so glad that Don was my sponsor. Don, in 16 years of sobriety, put a pipe in it because he was bipolar and he stopped taking medications. The only thing we can figure, put a hose in his exhaust and went to sleep in his van. And I'm so grateful that he always told me, because I used to see this a lot, you know, where people would get their sponsor and put them on this pedestal. And if something happened to their sponsor, they were lost sheep, you know. And he always said, my only job here is to get you to God. Because you don't never know where you're going to be when maybe there isn't a meeting, or maybe there isn't another alcoholic, or maybe, you know, who knows what. He said, have your friendships, have your fellowship, but you also got to have this relationship with God, because God is the only thing you will always be able to count on. He said, I could drink tomorrow. I don't know if that was some kind of a premonition he had way back when or what. Doesn't matter. That's what he did. And I started living my life according to those guidelines. You know, I was driving a 1973 Volkswagen for most of my sobriety. Had almost 300,000 miles on it. They called it the Godmobile. Because it is the only God could keep that thing running. It had rusty fenders and and I got a million stories about it too, and there's not enough time. But every time I got in that car, I didn't turn the radio on. I talked to God. God, please make it start. God, please get me across town to that meeting, you know? Because that's what I told my sponsor. I said, Donnie, I got this car, and you don't understand. This car, it ain't going to get me to another meeting or to another day's work. And he'd say, you know what? When I came in, I had an old panel truck I bought from another alcoholic running on 5 cylinders. I told this guy, my sponsor, it probably wouldn't run. He says, I drove it 5 years and sold it to another alcoholic. He says, so just get in it, because he says, God makes things happen with everything, you know? Not just the spiritual shit on Sunday, but every part of your life. And so I started living my life like that, in seeking, continually seeking to do whatever I could do to improve my conscious contact with God. You know? And because I was willing to do that, I live a life today that is beyond my wildest dreams. Yeah, you know. I'm not living the life I deserve. This is strictly grace for me. God's grace. You know, I came in here and I was so broken. And I shared this at a meeting here last Sunday that, you know, Chuck C., you know, I mean, the last thing you could have told a guy like me, and you understand from where I told you I came, the worst thing in the world you could say to me was that I was egotistical. I probably am, you know. But that's the worst thing in the world you could tell me. And I knew I wasn't because I felt like I'd been a doormat my whole life. You know, because I was so afraid and a lot of people walk all over me and stuff until the volcano would go off. And then you didn't want to be in the same state, you know. You get just crazy violent. But it wasn't until I read Chuck C's book, A New Pair of Glasses, and he defined ego as a conscious feeling of separation from God, from yourself, and from your fellow man. I got the answer. I got the golden key right there. You know, because that conscious feeling of separation from God is right up there in those first four steps. That conscious feeling of separation from my fellows is right there. 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. And that conscious feeling of separation from myself is right there. 10, 11, 12. And it's not hard. My sponsor used to tell me that. I want to complicate it, you know. Because I'm, you know, I think I'm a little bit smart. I'm not. But I want to complicate it. And I used to say, he'd say, you know, there's no wrong way to do it. Just do it. You know. And when I just did it, and when I just continue to do it, because you see, it isn't something we just do. The steps aren't designed, and the traditions aren't designed to do them. You know, at a step study, I went to a step study back in 59. You know, changed my life. No, the book tells us this is a design for living which solves all of our problems. So what do we have to do? We have to learn to incorporate these steps into our everyday life. I drive a concrete truck. You know, I'm in the construction trades. You know, it's not a mamby-pamby kind of a job. You know, you're out there with all these big thugs and everything. But I go out and I love them, you know, and I treat them like God's watching me, you know. I pull up at a job and a guy says, "Oh, you're going to have to do them back over here." And I say, "Hey, whatever job makes your job easier is what I'm here to do, pal." You know, the minute I got on the job, I'm working for you. And they look at you like, you know, because everybody else that shows up says, "Hey, you know, F you, I'm not, it's my truck, I'm doing it my way, you know." But by learning to live life that way, stop fighting people, places, and things. That's right here. Real simple. This is the guide right here. It's real simple. Read this book and incorporate it into your life. And if you don't understand it, grab somebody. Grab me. Grab anybody in this room. They'd love to help you. You know, because one of the other reasons as much as I hate coming up here, I don't mind doing it. Just like I don't mind standing out in the parking lot after a meeting with somebody and giving them the spiritual Gatling gun, you know. Because my mind doesn't give me this information that I've shared with you tonight voluntarily. My mind still says, and has all week leading up to tonight, you're a piece of shit. You know, you don't know nothing. You haven't done it right. You know, you're going to go blank and you deserve it. Now I'm trying to figure out how to buy more time. But when I get in that out in that parking lot or up in the mountains with a group of guys and I get a minute to sit down, And for that minute, we get to speak with what Bill Wilson called the language of the heart. And my heart gets to connect to your heart. And screw that macho bullshit, you know, because what I realized today is it wouldn't have served me anyway. You know, because I just do fine without it today. You know, I just want to go around loving people the way my sponsor taught me. And I would like, I know I'm out of time, but I would like to just share one more story that just came to mind tonight when Randy and I were having dinner. He was talking about, and this is kind of where my spiritual journey really began for me. Talking about the Betty Ford Center out in Palm Springs. He's got a friend that was out there. And I had an experience when my wife left me, before she left me in sobriety, the one I got sober for, who left anyway. God's got a sense of humor, doesn't he? But I love this story because it shows the power of what we've tapped into here. And my wife's mom was dying. She'd been very ill for a long time, and she was in the Eisenhower Medical Center out in Palm Springs. And we'd been there for about 5 days. I was like 6 months sober, and it was right after I'd had my relapse and came back. So I'm trying to be there for her, and I'm trying to be there for her aunt, and I'm trying to be there for her mom's older uncle, and all these people were depending on me, you know. And I'm trying to do what you guys are trying to teach me how to do, is be responsible and just listen and just love them and do what you can and put one foot in front of the other. But I've been out here for 5 days, you know, without a meeting. And at that time, I was going to 3 to 4 meetings a day. And I'm depleted. And we get down there on a Sunday morning to the hospital, and the doctor says, it's just a matter of a couple hours now. And I took a big sigh, and I told my wife, I said, look, I'm going to go down and get a cup of coffee and give you a little time with your mom. I'll be right back. And I went downstairs, and it was early morning, and I remember walking out behind the Eisenhower Medical Center, and I'm looking across the desert at the sun rising, you know, and I'm contemplating this whole God thing that, you know, that you guys are talking about here, and how it differed from the God thing that I came in with, you know, and was raised with, a personal God, you know, that would do for you, you know, when you really needed it. And so I just started talking, and I said, God, I don't know who you are. I don't know what you are. I don't know if you are. But I said, I've been here in Palm Springs now for 5 days trying to be the best person I could be for all these people while this woman passes. And please, if you could, I know I don't deserve it, but if you could just give me the strength to get through this until I can get back, you know, in town and stuff, you know, to help them to get through this, I'd really appreciate it. I know I don't deserve it, but please do it for them, you know. And I turned to walk away and go back inside. That was my first feeble attempt at a humble prayer. And I stopped after I took a couple steps, and I looked back over my shoulder, and I remember saying, you know, God, actually what I could use is a meeting, you know. And then I laughed and I chuckled and I turned and I started to walk back away, back into the hospital. And as I walked around this little path around the side of the building, there was another building over here. I didn't know what it was. And there was a path that went that way, kind of veered off. And something told me to follow that path around there because I saw cars like coming around from the street. And so I started to walk over there. And of course, as I come around this bend, I start to see the expanse of a parking lot. And I'm still trying to figure out what this building is. And I see all these cars pulling in, you know. And I'm going, nah. So I go around to the front, and I'm looking, and the sign for the place is out on the street, on the curb. the people are pouring in, and so I'm looking for somebody, you know, approachable, you know, in my condition. And so this little old lady comes walking up, and I said, "Excuse me, ma'am." I says, "You know, what is this place? What's going on?" She goes, "Oh, you don't know." She says, "This is the Betty Ford Center. It's Alcohol Awareness Week. Alcohol Awareness Week, and John Bradshaw is going to speak here in about 20 minutes." And I ran back upstairs, told my wife what had just happened, and ran back and got my meeting. And he talked about healing the shame that binds you. Those of you who know John Bradshaw, he's a recovered alcoholic also, who does a lot of work. And I got filled up. The people, just like the people in this room tonight, fill me up. Until I runneth over, you know, and then I go give it away. And that's what you did for me that day. You all filled me up in that. All the people in that room filled me up. And when I went back, I got to be there and be strong, you know, while my wife endured, you know, the passing of her mother and helping her aunts and helping her uncle and doing all this for everybody and everything. And that, like I say, started me on a spiritual journey that I continue today. You know, I had an experience a few years back. I went to I read a book and I don't know, got a calling, whatever you want to call it. You know, I go a lot of spiritual retreats and I do a lot of spiritual readings and have a lot of spiritual practice, and I have a very good relationship with my God. And something told me I had to follow what this guy in this book did, and that was take a 600-mile pilgrimage across France and Spain, following an ancient pilgrimage route back in 2003. And I did that walk, and it was the hardest thing I ever did, and I didn't know why. But what your people taught me to do was put one foot in front of the other, and don't worry about why. Just take the actions. And when I completed that walk and came back, my wife, my third wife, who I had just married at the time, got very ill, went on a disability. We got burned. We had to move. We moved out to East County and weren't even there a month and got burned out and lost everything in the Cedar Fire. And all these things happened. And I immediately knew that day when I drove away from that fire what God had me take that walk for. Because I spent 34 days walking 600 miles and doing nothing but contemplating God and God's will for me. And I felt so embraced when I finished that walk. I felt God's arms wrapped around me. And I knew He was preparing me for something, but I didn't know what. And I was able to get through all that stuff, you know. And that wife left a couple of years ago, and at the same time she was divorcing me, I lost my mom, my dad, and my uncle in a 3-week period. You know? And I got to stand up in a church full of people and do the eulogy. Something I could have never done, that scared little boy who walked into Alcoholics Anonymous almost 20 years ago. So I know I've gone a little bit over, but and I wish I could share more with you. You know, if you want to talk to me or get my number, I'd be happy to talk to anybody out here. To share my experience, strength, and hope, because that's what you've given me. I came here an empty shell of a man, you know, kind of like the Humpty Dumpty, you know, and you guys put me back together again, and I'll be forever grateful. And I love you, and thank you very much.